Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's Louisiana Eats, Native American Food Authority Loretta Barrett Oden shares the bounty of indigenous ingredients that has sustained her people for thousands of years. Then, we continue our discussion with writer Penelope Dane, who's working on a new book called The Gift of Rice. Wait till you hear what Penelope's accomplished using Louisiana rice flour. And we round out this week's menu by exploring America's vegan food scene. We've got quite the culinary adventure lined up for you on this week's Louisiana Eats. Loretta Barrett Oden has been referred to as the Julia Child of Native American food. An Oklahoma native, Loretta has roots in both the Potawatomi tribe and on the Mayflower, but her heart lies in the food of her grandma's kitchen, a place that was always filled with laughter and love. Loretta, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
Tell me how your knowledge and love for Native American food was originally nurtured from childhood.
It really is literally what you just said. You know, growing up in the kitchen, my mom was one of 12 kids. I was blessed on both sides of the family with grandmas and great grandmas. So the kitchen, you know, I'm not going to talk about my age, but this was a while ago. And so a lot of gardening, a lot of fresh, wonderful food to work with. And it's just the kitchen is the place to be.
Well, despite being America's really true indigenous cuisine, I think Native American cooking is still one of the least known and most misunderstood. For instance, so many ingredients that are identified with other cultures originally are from the Americas. So let's talk about some of those. Give me some examples.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, don't get me started, Poppy. Oh, the list is so long, but one particular one is Irish potatoes.
Yes.
I mean, you know, literally thousands and thousands of varieties of potatoes originated and grew in South America, Bolivia, Peru, corn, beans, squash, chili peppers, chocolate.
Chocolate. Yes, it really didn't come from Switzerland.
No, it didn't. And that Belgium chocolate is not the best there is. Oh, Moctezuma kind of had a corner on that market.
Well, you know, two things that, well, actually, more than that, that surprised me. Avocados.
Yes.
Papayas. And pineapple?
And pineapples. Hawaii had never lain an eye nor grown a pineapple prior to Dole taking them there to grow them on plantations.
And the papayas?
Papayas, yes. Papayas, again, a tropical fruit, but in Oklahoma, all along the southeast, in the Carolinas, and all, you've heard the old song when you were growing up, picking up pawpaws, putting them in your pocket.
Yeah.
That's a variety of papaya that grows wild in the southeast region of the Americas.
How about vanilla?
The vanilla story is really, I love it. It's one of my favorites. You know, the vanilla bean comes from a particular species of orchid that grows in the jungles, let's say in the Amazon basin somewhere. This particular plant blossoms at night for only one 24-hour period. There was only one species of bee that pollinated this flower who blossomed open at night. Some time comes, the seed pod forms, it falls to the jungle floor, it ferments, and someone walking down that trail said, "Something smells real good around here. I wonder what it is." And of course, you know, our vanilla today, it's all hand pollinated. Tahitian, you see all of the different kinds of vanilla.
Yes.
But it did originate in the Americas.
I was wondering if you could give us dishes that you believe are truly emblematic of these people.
Oh, my. Where does one start? I talk about my ingredients list as being anything that existed in pre-Columbian times from Nunavut to Tierra del Fuego. So that covers a lot of territory.
It does.
I consider, you know, whatever tribe or group you belong to, whether in Mexico or South America, whatever, you know, whatever grew in this great new world before we were discovered. We really didn't know we were lost anywhere, but there's a heck of a lot of food out there. And in my travels, that's what I really tried to do, was track through all of this food. And this food is as diverse as we are as Indian people. There are hundreds and hundreds of tribes. There are hundreds of mutually unintelligible languages. And our food is so diverse from region to region, from the Northwest Coast, the salmon, through the plains, the buffalo, the venison, the quail, a lot of corned beans and squash, which is pretty pan-American.
Mm-hmm.
They were grown and eaten by most of the native people. But the food is very, very regional specific and quite delicious. It's just a never-ending list.
Well, since you mentioned the buffalo,
oh,
you know, nowadays you can go to grocery stores often and see buffalo again. Do you have any tips for how to cook it?
Yes, I do. I've been cooking buffalo for quite a few years now. It's a very lean meat. It's lower in fat and cholesterol than even like the white breast meat of turkey and
really?
Some fish. If you're going to eat red meat, buffalo is the one to choose. And I know that Ted Turner likes to refer to them always as bison. It's buffalo to
okay.
me. But because it is so lean, you have to be careful not to overcook it. So it's kind of low and slow.
Mm-hmm.
While I cook the tenderer cuts, like the tenderloin, always over a wood fire, if
mm-hmm.
possible. Yum.
Yeah.
I just, a nice size tenderloin, I'll mark it and let it stay on there for just a few minutes. Take it off, because otherwise it turns into something like chewing on an inner tube.
Yeah.
It gets very tough very quickly.
Well, I know you learned a great deal about the regional foods of the Native Americans through your in-depth tour of the foods that you took in your series on PBS, Seasoned with Spirit, A Native Cook's Journey. Tell us about all the places you visited as you filmed this series.
Oh, this was one of the most astounding experiences of my life. And it's actually how I've ended up here at Jazz Fest. We came down to scout locations for foods of the Gulf Coast region. Became acquainted with the people of the United Homa Nation. We went down and just, oh my goodness, had the greatest, greatest time. I was fishing at night with a bow and arrow on the bayous in an airboat.
Oh, that's
I mean,
fun.
Oh, my. And it looks like some intergalactic thing on film. It's just absolutely terrific. But we did the foods of this amazing region. We did the wild rice harvest from the Ojibwe White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. Did a great desert show down in southern Arizona, southwest of Tucson. How many is that? My goodness, I lose count. Where else did I go?
Well, even though that all of these are classic Native American foods, how did you see the differences vary by region?
It's very diverse, and it really has to do with region-specific foods. It has to do with the weather. It has to do with the geology of the area. You look at the desert, you're dealing with desert plants. You know, it was amazing. You step out onto that great desert and you think, how could anyone possibly survive here?
Yeah.
And then when I went out and harvested the saguaro cactus fruit, the prickly pear cactus, they even harvest the cholla buds, the little unopened flower buds. There's moisture out there. There are desert beans that they grow. The chiltepin pepper
mm-hmm.
is specific to the southern Arizona desert and is probably the precursor, the first of the chili peppers. Just looks like a little round red bead, and it's just hotter than the hubs of Hades.
Yeah.
Well, did you learn these recipes because people had them written down?
No. That's been one of the challenges. We are an oral tradition people. So generation through generation, you know, cooking with the aunties and the grandmas and all of that, all of this food knowledge, as well as the medicine knowledge that comes along with that, because food is our medicine, this was passed on. And I have a few very treasured handwritten recipes from my mom and my grandmas, but no, not a lot was written down.
Well, you mentioned that Native Americans also regard food as medicine. Give us some examples of how that works.
Well, if you think about food overall, each bite of everything we put into our mouths, you know, has some effect on our bodies. If not for sustenance, it's going into our bodies and becoming a part of who we are. But one of my favorite medicines is, you know, you think of bear aspirin. Mm-hmm. I mean, my goodness, how long has aspirin been around? And that comes from the willow trees. Mm. We have pharmaceutical companies to this day stomping around in the Amazon and places, you know, still very remote places, looking for this indigenous knowledge of medicines. Was on a panel during Jazz Fest with Pa Dardar of the United Homa Nation, and he brought in this whole array of these wonderful plant medicines, everything from bee balm to horse's tail to all of these things, and they all had medicinal qualities. Banana leaves.
Tell me about that banana leaf.
Can you believe that? I saw the banana leaf laying there and I said, oh my goodness. Of course, the first thing that runs through my mind is, well, I can make a tamal out of that. Uh-huh. You know, I put some moss in there and wrap up that. Or I've cooked a lot of fish in banana leaves.
And it's delicious.
It's wonderful. But take a banana leaf, wrap it around your head, as the Homa people do. That takes care of a headache. Any congestion in your head, maybe even a hangover.
Wow. Well, who knew? And I'll tell you what, Louisiana is filled with banana trees everywhere. So,
and is there a real need for a hangover medication in
maybe,
Louisiana?
Maybe there is. Well, with all of this inherent native knowledge about food as medicine and the way to take care of yourself, I find it very, very curious that today it seems to be Native Americans who are suffering disproportionately, really, from food-related diseases like diabetes and all those bad things. How has this happened?
Oh, it's a horrifying problem. And unfortunately, you know, it's spreading throughout our society. You notice we're all growing to larger beings than we should be and not quite as healthy as we should be. But people have genetic
proclivities
to be able to handle and their bodies to process certain foods. In particular, with amongst the Native American people, because there was no wheat, hence no white wheat flour, there was no dairy at all in the Americas. Past mama's milk, there was no milk, butter, cheese, none of that. And there is a lot of lactose intolerance amongst the people. The celiac disease problem with the gluten intolerance, more and more research is being done on that, and wheat almost seems to push a button. It's almost a trigger food that pushes a button that I'm still hungry, eat some more. Mm. So we really have a problem. The tribe I was talking about down in southern Arizona, the Tanatham, have the highest rate of type 2 diabetes of any peoples on the planet.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's a sad problem.
So how do you see this being corrected?
I think that not only amongst my people, but everyone, we need to reconnect with Mother Earth. We need to take shoes off, get out there and dig in the dirt, walk around, plant something. I don't care if you plant one tomato, one radish seed, lettuce seed, whatever. Get out there and grow something and feel the warmth of our Mother Earth. feel the excitement of watching that little seed sprout or that tomato grow and produce something that you can actually eat. And I think the real root to all of that is the babies, the kiddos. Mm-hmm. We've got to change the way our kids eat. And the sooner we can get to that, the better. I don't think of anything better than going out and playing in the dirt and planting seeds and, you know.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming to shed the light on an American food mystery that we should really all know about.
Oh, thank you, Poppy. It's my honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Native American Food Authority, Loretta Barrett Oden. When we come back, writer Penelope Dane takes us on a gluten-free eating adventure. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Recently, I had the rare opportunity to work in the kitchen with Dominica's chef, Alon Shaya. One of the dishes we prepared together was risotto, a creamy rice dish from northern Italy that's surprisingly easy to prepare. The key ingredient is a short grain rice called arborio, which swells and becomes tender as a combination of stock and wine is continuously stirred into the pot. Alon's unique method for perfect risotto starts by toasting the rice in a completely dry pan, which he says brings out the natural oils in the rice. In another pot, he sautés onions and olive oil till they're translucent before combining them with the dry toasted rice. Then, simmering stock is stirred into the rice by the ladleful as the rice absorbs the liquid. As you're stirring, add a little wine for flavor. Your proportions will be about 3 cups of stock and wine to 1 cup of arborio rice. Risotto is the perfect backdrop to any ingredient you might want to highlight. Seafood, vegetables, and herbs can all be added in any combination. But before serving, stir a generous amount of butter and Parmesan cheese into the luscious, creamy rice dish. When I make risotto, I often use Kurt Uncle's Cajun grain. Even though it's brown jasmine rice, the result is a healthy, distinctive Louisiana style of this northern Italian classic. For a copy of my risotto recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Alon Shaya's risotto is always delicious Louisiana Eats. Massachusetts native Penelope Dane hated both coffee and shellfish when she moved to Louisiana in 2005, but all that has certainly changed now. Life in our delicious state has been such a great adventure for Penelope, and one of her biggest revelations came in the form of our very own fresh rice. Penelope, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hi.
Well, now that you're down here, Louisiana rice became quite a passion of yours because it's fresh here. So tell us about how that came about.
So I overheard Kurt at the farmer's market.
Kurt Uncle.
Yes. And he was talking to a customer about how flavor and nutrition are linked and how important it is to soak the rice. So I bought some of the rice and I just couldn't believe what rice actually tasted like, that it had a flavor when I'd grown up just thinking of it as this side dish.
So you started eating Cajun grain. How did you decide to write a cookbook about this?
Well, because I spend so much time experimenting with the rice and the rice flour and Kurt's rice grits, and he's working on a new product, some rice meal that's in between the rice grits and the rice flour.
So maybe this will be something that you would be breading those shrimp you love so much now with?
Oh, yeah. I haven't tried that yet.
Well, I haven't seen the meal at all yet, but the rice flour was a pretty recent development. He's only been doing that, I don't know, maybe 18 months or so, I think, right?
Yeah. And I mean, we had been talking probably for about 4 or 5 years. And so I started buying the rice flour as soon as he got it and making gluten-free stuff.
Walk me through a recipe that might have flour in it and the sort of alterations that you have to make it work.
So for this rice bread, which is instead of a cornbread, what I will do is I'll substitute almost one for one. I do find that I need to add a little bit more of the rice flour than I would of a wheat flour because it's a little bit less absorbent. But the trick is really that binder. And so a lot of the commercial gluten-free stuff and a lot of the cookbooks will tell you to use xanthan gum or guar gum. They have a weird off flavor. Mm-hmm. And the more stuff sits, the more that flavor comes out. And the more gluten-free things I ate, the more I noticed the flavor and I didn't like it. So I had to go looking for something else. So I found a blogger that was using ground up flax seed and ground up chia seeds for a binder.
Wow, like the chia pet.
Yes. But that makes a nice paste. Gluten is the glue, right? And it holds the air pockets and it holds bread together. So you can use the chia and flax. They'll imitate what a gluten strand does in a piece of bread. So I'm going to start experimenting with that this summer.
I know that one of your goals is achieving a perfect gluten-free sourdough bread. Tell me about the process of doing that.
Well, it starts with research. So, like, I start researching just how people do the wheat-based sourdough.
And yeah, because sourdough has to have a sourdough starter. So what does your starter become?
Well, the first starter I experimented with is I tried to capture some wild yeast.
So how did you catch it? I mean, it sounds like you went hunting with a butterfly net. What was this about exactly?
I went hunting with pineapple juice.
Okay.
So you mix, I think it was about a cup of brown rice flour, cup of water, and then you add a little bit of pineapple juice. And that keeps the acidity up so that mold doesn't grow, and it makes it a better environment for the wild yeast that you're trying to catch.
That is fascinating. So then how long did it take before the starter started to start?
Well, one of the things I love about Louisiana is when you are dealing with wild yeast or fermentation, your time is half. In the books, it says 1 to 2 weeks. I think it took 3 days, if that, before it started bubbling away.
Nothing like a little heat and humidity to help mm-hmm. with any process like that. So then what happened?
So then I just did a lot of math and baked with it, because with a true sourdough starter, you have to pay attention to hydration levels. And because I'm working out of 3 or 4 different cookbooks, I have to, like, come up with a combined recipe in my head, do the math, convert it to gluten-free, and then make whatever I'm going to make. And in that case, it was some hamburger buns that were really good.
They're
flat. I mean, the gluten-free stuff is, it doesn't have that same rise, mm-hmm. which is why I'm interested in the Irish moss seaweed gel, because I've seen the raw foods people getting a really good rise out of that gel, kind of captures the air in a similar way that the gluten does.
That's fascinating. So something else that fascinated me is that it's not just wheat-based things that you are altering. You also are transforming corn-based standards like tortillas. So how do you make a rice-based tortilla?
There are two routes you can go, and I haven't figured out which one is going to be the best. South Asian tradition is you can soak the rice for a couple days, grind it up in the food processor. You can make pancakes out of that, basically, if you add a little bit lentil called dal mm-hmm. to it. So for the tortillas, I'm going to try going that route too. with grinding up the whole grains of rice.
I read a synopsis of what you're working on, and I know that in your book we're going to see Louisiana standards like jambalaya and gumbo. How do you make a roux using rice flour? What are the differences in roux making?
The difference is the rice flour is not going to form that ball. You use about the same amount as you would for wheat flour to make the roux. It's not going to form the ball. It's going to cook, but it's not going to bubble up and turn really dark the way a flour will. More with the rice flour, I go by smell more than sight. And when I start to smell that divine, nutty wonder, then I know, all right, it's time to add some broth. Or if I'm making a sausage gravy, that's when I add the milk.
Tell me about your research with Louisiana's Native Americans.
Well, I know Kurt has been talking to a man who's a member of the Tunica tribe from Mississippi. So I'm hoping to get a chance to talk to him. And that is something that I've just started to get into. I've learned some about the food of the native peoples, like the Wampanoags in Massachusetts, through reading the accounts when someone would be kidnapped into a tribe or they would choose to leave the settlements and go live with a tribe. And the things that are written from that, you can find little bits of recipes and about food in that. And also in so short stories and fiction will have a lot about the food ways. So I have just started to get into how am I going to, I'm going to be looking for just literature and writing about these particular tribes and then work on getting in contact with some people and talking with them.
Okay, well, once you've got that together, you come back and let us know what the Choctaws and the Homas and the Coushatas all have to say about their styles of cooking. And when do you think the book's going to be published?
I'm hoping to finish it in the next year. I'm also finishing my dissertation.
Well, you are one busy woman, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to drive down here to speak with us. So thank you so much, and keep us informed about the progress, would you?
Thanks. I will.
Author Penelope Dane and The Gift of Rice. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is a creative community activist crucially involved in New Orleans' Central City neighborhood. In 2011, our hero joined forces with Dr. Leslie Brown to launch a group that challenges New Orleanians to eat local.
Eat Local challenges have been going on in different parts of the United States for years, and right now in Louisiana is a good time to implement a policy where we focus on some of the natural resources of Louisiana. It's kind of like the Crescent City Classic. You can run that race whenever you want, but this is kind of a motivation to get started and to take advantage of it.
Dubbed the NOLA Locavores, they designated June as Eat Local Month. Hundreds responded to their challenge to source food strictly within a 200-mile radius of the city. With so many hungry locavores investigating edible local ingredients, Louisiana's delicious pantry grew by leaps and bounds. Local restaurants also joined the effort, offering meals designed for the locavores' dining out enjoyment. Following the success of the second Eat Local Challenge in 2012, our culinary heritage hero launched another effort to coincide with the most American of food holidays, Thanksgiving. Local chef Chris DeBar of Serendipity Restaurant rose to the occasion. He crafted a meal exclusively from Louisiana ingredients that could have been the first Thanksgiving dinner, if only the pilgrims had been lucky enough to land on Louisiana shores.
When we started doing our research, it was interesting to learn that there is an entire culture of people out there that are researching indigenous foods. And one of the things that I found was particularly interesting was acorn flour. And acorns are something that we've been stepping on every day since we were kids. But the indigenous peoples knew how to prepare these acorns. And you can buy acorn flour online today. Acorn flour is a substitute for wheat flour, and it's not crazy to think of eating acorns.
That's why Lee Stafford, founder of the Eat Local Challenge, is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support by Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations, Lee, and thank you for bringing such focus to the true diversity of our Louisiana pantry. If you'd like to join this year's challenge, learn how by visiting nolalocavore.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and the Eat Local Challenge is all about Louisiana Eats. We're taking another short break, but when we return, we're going vegan. Don't go anywhere. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Jill Benson is a real pro at hunting delicious, out-of-the-way places where food folks are cooking up something good. As Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Jill is here with the latest scoop. So, Jill, what do you have for us today?
Poppy, I want to talk to you about Criolla Cafe in Grand Coteau and Chef Carol Bagnon. Let me tell you a little about Carol's past. She was a realtor, and she told me that since she was 12 years old, she has cooked compulsively. In the evening, she'll shove full dinners across the fence at her neighbors. Well, about 14 years ago, she moved to Lafayette to attend nursing school and continued the practice of feeding total strangers and shoving food on her neighbors. Well, someone asked her to cater a wedding. She'd never done this. Catered the wedding for 125 people, and one of the guests came up and made her an offer. I would like to set you up with a restaurant in a space I own.
Well.
She decided to go for it. But here's the thing. People said to Carol, you've got to be nuts to go into a new business at 68 years old, that business. So she said, well, I'm going to be 68 anyway, so what the hell?
My kind of girl.
Oh, she's my kind of woman. So I love her restaurant. There's a wraparound porch. It's an intimate space that seats 24 people. And she's crammed this little space with beautiful European antiques and oil paintings and soft lighting and toile fabric, and it feels like an elegant home dining room.
That's so nice.
She kept her kitchen wide open so she can talk to customers, and she's my kind of woman. She can talk. So she plans her menu every day from scratch. She said she just cooks what's fresh and what she feels like cooking. And I called her this morning to see what was on the menu. Today, she's serving up old-fashioned smothered steak with black-eyed peas over fluffy jasmine rice. And she made something she calls her over-the-top salad. It's a big bowl of organic greens topped with thinly sliced, freshly grilled sirloin. And that's topped with a mound of grilled Vidalia onions. And then she gilds the lily with blue cheese.
Oh, Lord, that sounds good.
Doesn't that sound divine?
You are making me hungry.
I know. I'm feeling a little hungry here, too. But Carol is known for just beautiful, graceful renditions of Creole and French-inspired classics. When I was there recently, she served up steak Diane, and she flamed it with real brandy at the table side, and she served it with creamy, twice-baked potatoes.
You just don't see that on menus much anymore.
You don't.
And Jill, she doesn't have any classical training. She's just sort of self-taught.
She is self-taught. She started when she was 12, and she is a serious cook.
Well, Well, I'm ready to drive right over there now. Is there anything I should know about when I can find her?
Well, Carol works judiciously. She's open for lunch every Wednesday through Saturday, as well as for dinner every other Saturday evening when she hosts Dinner with Friends, which is a $65 four-course reservation-only candlelit meal where the wine flows freely.
Well, that sounds like a good time.
Absolutely. I've not been to that Saturday evening dinner with friends, but it's on my bucket list.
Sounds like a lovely way to spend a weekend if you secure a little B&B.
And there are many little B&Bs around Grand Coteau.
All right. I'm ready for a road trip. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you, Poppy.
Founding editor of Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine, Jill Benson, our Louisiana Eats roving reporter.
On the road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.
New York native Kristen Lajeunesse will travel for vegan food. In search of a lifestyle of self-discovery and nonconformity, Kristen quit her job and hit the road with the intention of visiting all 50 states while spreading her message of the significance of a cruelty-free, all-plant-based diet. Kristen, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much.
Let's start at the beginning. How did you become a vegan?
Sure. Well, it's actually kind of an interesting story. It started with my older brother, who is 5 years older than I am. He dropped out of high school and decided to follow the band Phish around the country. After a few years of that, he returned home with dreads and tattoos and announced his vegetarianism. And my parents were horrified. They said, oh no, you're going to die. What about protein? And so my mom, doing what she always does best, she ended up doing a bunch of research to try to prove to him why vegetarianism was unhealthy. And through her research, she found the exact opposite. And so when I was 16 years old, my parents sat me down and they said, we'd like to become vegetarian as a family. And I begrudgingly kind of went along with it. I didn't know much about it. I didn't do my own research, but I have a really close relationship with my parents and I trust them. So I'm like, all right, I'll give it a try. And then what really did it for me is I was at a veggie expo in Syracuse, New York, where I was living at the time. And I listened to a dietitian by the name of George Eisman. And he talked a lot about how dairy isn't necessary and how unhealthy it is for our bodies and also the animal welfare aspects. And it was kind of in that moment when I put more of the focus on what I was hearing and not just judging everyone around me, how valuable that information was. And so that was on August 27th, 2006, I believe, that I decided to go vegan that day. And my parents had already been vegan for a couple of years at that point, so the transition was pretty easy for me.
How are you funding this trip?
It's entirely based on donations. So everything from the gas to the food is all funded through generous donors.
And I understand that you got it literally kickstarted with Kickstarter.
Indeed.
Would you explain how that works?
Sure. It's a website, kickstarter.com, that is solely focused on helping entrepreneurs, small business owners, and the like raise money for projects. They've actually been pretty popular over the last few years, and it's been a really great and unique way for people to raise money. And so I did some research and found that my project did fit into their requirements because you do have to apply to be a part of their website. So last fall, I created a short video that talked about my project and what I planned to do with the money that was raised. And through the very tightly knit vegan network that we have throughout the country, I was fortunate to meet my goal, because if you don't meet your set goal on Kickstarter, you get $0. So it's all or nothing. So I met my goal and I used that money to get a vehicle for the trip and hit the road.
What is your ultimate goal of making this trip?
It's kind of a multi-purpose goal. I guess initially I set out to help spread awareness about veganism and how it ties into healthy living and the environment and animal welfare. But it also is, you know, started out because I just really wanted a lifestyle change. I fell in love with food after becoming vegan, and I always wanted to travel. I always said, oh, I wish I could go here or there, but I found reasons not to. And there was just a day that I said, you know, I'm going to find a way to follow these passions that I have, which is food and travel. And it just kind of took off from there.
So where have the travels taken you so far?
I've gone down the entire East Coast, and then from Florida, from the West Coast of Florida, I went up through, let's see, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Michigan. I went up into Toronto and then drove from Toronto over to Minneapolis and then back down until I got here. So I'm basically snaking my way south, north across the country.
And you're really sort of a vegan missionary of sorts, spreading your message. Are you finding any negative pushback?
So far, not really. Surprisingly, the only negative pushback I've gotten is within the vegan community itself.
Really?
Yes, I haven't gotten any negativity from non-vegans so far, but there have been a few people that have claimed this is a glorified vacation or that I'm using the donations inappropriately. And, you know, what I can say about that is it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. I'm not earning any money right now, and I'm solely doing this not only for self-exploration, but to also, like I said earlier, spread the vegan message. And it's something that I'm really, really passionate about. So it's interesting to me that the only pushback have been just from a few vegans within the community itself.
Well, you know, it's funny that you bring that up because, I don't know, sometimes you meet people with these lifestyles and they're so adamant about it that they almost come across as angry. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, yeah. And there are definitely a variety of us within the vegan community. And everyone expresses their passion in different ways. But similarly, with any cause or with any project that people are really passionate about, you'll find people that they have a different way to spread the message. And some people come across as being a little more bold and rude than others. And some are a little easier to communicate with. And I think that variety does hold some value, though, because you'll find people that are moved more by one person's strategy than another.
Tell me about the regional differences that you're finding in vegan food from place to place.
Well, an interesting thing I noted is when I was in Florida, which some may not consider the true South, it was very another category of veganism. I guess it was very high in the raw food movement, which is uncooked whole fruits and vegetables. And there, nearly every other restaurant I went to in Florida, of which there were a little over 30 vegan restaurants, had mostly raw food. And so I found that really interesting. Another thing is in the South, vegan soul food is a big thing, which I think is relevant and really awesome that you can find food that is native to that region. You could say that you can get vegan style.
What's the easiest place that you have found to eat vegan?
Hands down, it would have to be New York City. According to happycow.net, which is a resource website that a lot of vegetarians and vegans use to find food, there are just under 200 all-vegan restaurants in the city and in the boroughs as well. So clearly, definitely New York City. You can walk around any corner and find vegan food.
Well, now you're in New Orleans. How are you finding the food scene here?
So far, it's been great. I haven't been here for even a full 24 hours yet, but I did have dinner last night at the Wandering Buddha, which is a 100% vegan restaurant. And I had a really nice conversation with the owner last night, too, while I was there, who recommended some other vegan places around. And compared to other major cities and states, Louisiana has a ways to go in terms of offering a lot of vegan stuff. But New Orleans is the only city in the entire state that has any vegan food.
Really?
In terms of 100% vegan restaurants, yes.
Fascinating. So what did you eat last night?
One was a seared tofu dish that came with some rice and some sautéed vegetables. And it sounds relatively simple, but I don't know what they do to flavor it, but it was absolutely one of the best meals I've had on the road so far, which says something that I've eaten at. I counted earlier today, I've eaten at more than 250 vegan restaurants so far, and this meal was a standout for sure. I also had an appetizer there that was like a rice pancake kind of a thing with an amazing sweet sauce, dipping sauce, and it was just fantastic.
Do you think there's some vegan jambalaya in your future?
Absolutely. I got some recommendations last night of a couple restaurants that, while not all vegan, they do offer a vegan jambalaya. So I'll be checking that out later today.
Well, with your big background in vegetarianism, you know, from a very young age, and observing what you have about the raw food movement, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts about the way some vegan restaurants and vegans manipulate the food to make it resemble something they can't have anymore because of their philosophy.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. I haven't really given it too much thought in terms of if I feel like we should call something chicken with quotes around it or something like that. I definitely appreciate the culinary skill it takes to take a clump of tofu and flavor in a way that resembles something that I might have had when I was much younger. However, some of the best meals that I've had so far on the road have come from restaurants that don't go in the faux meat or fake meat direction, where they really focus on using the whole vegetables and flavoring them in a way and putting them together in a way that really, I don't even know how it works, to be honest with you, but they do a phenomenal job. And so I guess my answer to your question is I like the faux meat dishes, but I tend to appreciate the ones that are just vegetable-based more.
Well, does that mean that you're more of a vegan eater instead of a vegan cook?
Absolutely. Yes. I enjoy cooking. Baking, I enjoy a little more, but I'm better at eating than any of those things.
Have you found any vegan restaurant chains?
Yes. There are two prominent ones, actually, throughout the U.S. One is called Loving Hut, which is actually an international chain, and it's an Asian-style, kind of pan-Asian-American-style restaurant. And the other is Native Foods, and they have a bunch of locations on the West Coast as well as in the Midwest, and they're making their way east. I believe they're planning to open a restaurant in Boston, too.
Where do you go next?
Texas is next, Houston specifically, which has a bunch of vegan restaurants there too. And actually, Texas as a whole, I found, is extremely vegan friendly, which I was surprised to learn. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, you think of it as the big meat state.
Yeah.
Now tell me, can you ever imagine going back to eating meat?
Absolutely not. After becoming vegan and understanding the health benefits as well as the animal welfare benefits and also the environmental aspects, I just could never, ever imagine going back. And actually, at the end of this month, I will have been vegan for 6 years. I've had zero health problems, and I fluctuated between eating lots of junk vegan food and eating healthy vegan food, because there is actually, you can certainly be unhealthy eating vegan, because there are a lot of those fake meats which are very processed and a lot of sugars and stuff that you can still consume and be unhealthy. But through my 6-year journey thus far, I have fallen in love with this lifestyle. There's nothing about it that deters me. And in fact, 2 years ago, I was vacationing in Chicago, and I decided that I wanted to make this statement of veganism a bit more permanent in my life, and I decided to get a tattoo that represents this lifestyle. So on my wrist, I have the international symbol for veganism or vegetarianism, which is a V with a little leaf on the end of it.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for stopping by to visit with us on Louisiana Eats, and happy trails.
Thank you so much.
Kristen LaJeunesse, traveling our nation in search of vegan food.
I'm going to keep well, my vegetables car off and sell my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan, and Westside Lights Egan Funeral Homes.
LCI Workers Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.